The barn was closed off to the boys the whole day of Christmas Eve, and Spencer would be all day there, no matter how cold it was. Luke remembered how small he was, and Whitney too, and how Lonnie, who was older, was always the leader. How they always wanted to do what Lonnie was doing, and how he and Whitney, in his mind when they were that small, were always wrestling and tumbling over each other like little puppies. How they never seemed to tire of climbing over and under and falling and climbing back and falling yet again over each other. And how Lonnie, in Luke's remembering, always seemed to have this patient kindness for them, as if he were older than, say, his 9 years, the shepherd to his diminutive flock of 5-year-olds. Luke's remembrance of Elizabeth when they were that small was of all that day cooking, and the smells of it beginning by late in the morning and building and sweeping on right through Christmas Day, when the smells of all of it would reach a kind of fragrant crescendo that by the time they would finally set down to Christmas dinner would have nearly exhausted their senses, living all day in a fever of expectation, and her stopping variously to see that they were bundled up enough against the cold, and then ushering them toward the door, with Lonnie taking them each by the hand. "You boys can walk up toward Doris's to see those lights, but be home before it gets dark, please." "But we want to ride Blue," Whitney says, who, when we were small, was the biggest animal we were allowed to be around, a great big 16-and-a-half-hand blue roan gelding, as old and as gentle as a long-legged old grandfather who had to be wary of where he placed his feet so that he would do nothing to jeopardize that stance of his legs, tired and knobbly, but still getting him eventually to where he figured he wanted to go. So solicitously careful when we were about him that in later years I wondered if he had somehow gained an instinct for us as being tiny two-legged creatures akin to the imagined long-lost phantom sons and grandsons never yet birthed into being out of his dim and indistinct memory behind that single regard on his graying face, bespeaking a boundless kind-eyed patience that somehow, in the ancient way of the beast, loved the young, the puppies, and the kittens, and the little boys, too. And Elizabeth says, "Not today, boys. You mind that barn, Lonnie, and be back before it's dark." And Lonnie says, "Yes'm." And we're tumbling and shoving each other down the long, long road that finally crosses the first cattle guard, smoothed over with snow that runs out of the ranch. The ground would be all filled up with the darkness of night when we'd finally leave the house to go down to the barn. And the western end of the sky, above and behind the high country, would just barely yet hold the very last of the light of day, fading so quickly that if you didn't think to watch for it, you'd forget and miss the very last of it, the day's end. There'd be 4 or 5 pickup trucks parked below the barn, and some of the folks from various surrounding ranches approaching it with their kids as we walked down from the house. And my remembrance is always of a crystal clear moonless night when the temperature is already below zero and the snow crunching so loud under our boots that you could hear the steps of the people all the way on the other side of the barn walking up from where they'd parked. And the stars by then, the stars seemed so full and distinct in the sky that you'd almost feel as if you could hear them, like the burning of distant torches, if you were to stop and really listen. There was one huge one in the east in the winter that I always remembered, and Whitney and I assumed it to be the same star that all the stories told about. It gave off color, and it stayed there all through the cold. Lonnie told us sometime later that it was the eye of the constellation of the dog, and we liked knowing that, because our reference on the ground was so intertwined with animals that it seemed only right for the stars to have a similar reference also. You could hear John Farrell's guitar from inside the barn when you were still ways away from it. Harley's Uncle John, who everybody called John Farrell, as if his two names, first and last, were really one name put together. The sound of the guitar and the clarity of the newborn night made everybody quiet as they approached. The loveliness of it, like an earth-bred accompaniment, achingly simple and pure, to the whelming night, like a universe cut from glass so thin and fragile at the same time that it's unimaginably deep and far, with the crunching snow and the sounds of the guitar on this side of the cold, and the stars close and far. on the other side. Whitney and I and Lonnie would all have fallen into that hush as we walked. And Elizabeth would squeeze my hand in my mitten without saying anything. And I could see her face in my mind without having to look up at her. We'd all be hushed as we entered the barn, as if it were really a church of sorts. And as I remember it, I really can't imagine any difference. In the far corner, against where the wall met the first stall, was where Spencer would have set up the tree that late the day before he had cut and drug down from somewhere off the far ridge that sat behind and above the ranch. Lonnie went with him on horseback, and we saw them watching from the parlor window, walking their horses in the darkness, coming up the wide snow-filled pasture with Lonnie's horse first and Spencer just to the side and slightly behind him, with the tree tied off at his saddle horn and dragging over the surface of the snow. It was all candles. The whole tree was all hung somehow with lit candles, so many of them that their light seemed to fill with a soft delicacy nearly all the darkness. The light from the candles was so sharp a vision in me when we'd enter from out of the hard, cold blackness of the new night that it seemed to hurt me in my chest with how beautiful it was, the shocking, delicate vision of that light. And then you would see that all amongst the candles were hung apples and carrots and a countless array of fruits and vegetables wherever the broad boughs of the tree would support them. Hay bales would be set all about the earthen floor so that they formed sitting places around and back away from the tree and divided the barn in half with three or four horses all groomed with a tiny red and green knot of ribbon tied in their forelocks, walking freely about the other side of the bales and eating from the scattered hay and mounded grain that Spencer had set there for them. Several yearling cattle would be settled in two or three of the stalls, and a number of sheep would be in each of the other two stalls next to them. John Farrow would be sitting on one of the bales and playing and humming along to his fingers, picking on the strings of his instrument. With those gloves that leave the fingers' tips exposed, we thought he'd cut them out so he'd be able to play in the cold. And I remembered having a thought about cutting off the top of my mittens, but seemed to forget about it before actually getting it done. There'd be platters of cookies and pitchers of juice for the kids, an eggnog for the folks, and enough glasses to go all round, all set up on trays on top of three bales, piled one on top of the other against the near wall. The kids would break away from the folks, and the folks would cluster on the other side of John Farrow with handshakes all around, and all the good wishes spoken back and forth to each other that I seem to remember, along with the knowledge of people living close enough to the earth to be kin to the various other families of creatures living there also, in a harsh and generally ungiving environment that made us all, the Farrows, the next ranch over nearly 4 miles away, and Ollie Wheatman and his family and his hands and their families nearly 15 miles off to the south, all neighbors, folks that worked much longer hours than their work animals, from dark to dark and most always beyond, day after day, without heed of arbitrary divisions of time into weeks and months, and telling the passage of it in a lesser sense, from the daily birth and building and the diminishing and disappearing of the light, and from the subtle, inexorable nightly waxing and waning of the moon, and with the less awareness from the awesome, endless concentric circles of the fiery and yearning stars, and the greater sense of it by the births and deaths of the creatures given and removed from life in our high, clear valley, rimmed by the near hills on the one side and the harsh, crystalline mass of the far mountains on the other, by the deaths and births of all the creatures that frequented that tiny niche of earth, winged and two- and four-legged, and silver swimmers and arrow-like flyers and runners horned and not with cloven feet and some with 10 toes, the peach fuzz turning to whiskers on the Son of Man. And coming up from the barn some warm Saturday evening, and seeing the gangly little girl you'd known right from seed, suddenly standing on the porch like her own lovely ghost waiting on the breeze and hugging you round your neck that had to still smell of the horse you'd been shoeing, saying, "Your supper will get cold, Daddy," and kissing her cheek, a woman with her mother in her eyes and her own daughter there too, if you're wise enough to see that far. And time turning gray in your own beard, and your hands like limp old claws turned horny with callus, with the fingers cracking in the death-like cold and healing over, with the earth under the healed places and cracking open again like fissures in the frozen ground, waiting for the renewal of spring to restore what is held in abeyance back to the moist and fecund flesh. Another winter. For time here wasn't generally referred to in years, but rather in the winters we have lived through. The sun is low, and the warmth is brief, and the light lives on between the dark and the dark. John Farrell would be singing softly at first, so that we hadn't paid it any heed, as clear and soft in the pristine candlelight of the tree, as the sound that had been given voice by something gentle in the wind, until one by one the grown-ups would join in along with him, with the kids kind of gravitating back to lean against their folks' knees, as their young voices would catch a word here and there and make up the others, as their folks went along in the path that John Farrell led them, a pure and simple rising of voices, with someone or two of the ranchers droning along as if they'd caught themselves on one tone that probably sounded in their own ears as if they were warbling away in close harmony to those who were actually singing to the song's melody. A joining of voices in that delicate light that somehow seemed to generate a real warmth, a suspiration of living breath, and a warmth that was absolute, as if each of the creatures that lay or stood or sat in that drafty close place made enough of a contribution to the engendered atmosphere to actually produce a living heat from out of the barren cold that pressed against the outside walls. Then Spencer would set his spectacles low on his nose and stand close in front of the tree so that the light from it fell across his shoulders and onto the large child's book that he held and read from about the baby and the animals, and how the animals were all given human speech on this one night. And as I listened to the story which Spencer read every year, I remembered again that I'd planned to get up later in the night and get dressed and tiptoe out of the house and get my boots on just inside the front door and come back down to the barn so that I could hear what each of the horses and dogs and cats and the cattle and sheep, what each of them would really sound like when they spoke words, wondering what they would say to each other, and especially what they would say to me when I spoke to them. And Whitney looks at me from the corner of his eye so that I know he's thinking the same thing. But we wake up late, sometime before dawn, but way after midnight, and Whitney's already awake and dressing himself in the dark, and I rush to catch up with him, and he whispers fiercely, "Pa said they do it at midnight." And I whisper back at him, tucking the flannel hurriedly into my jeans, "Maybe they're still doing it, though, at least while it's still night." And we hurry down the stairs, shushing each other and holding the railing in the darkness. The cold freezes the inside of my nose. It's so cold, and I breathe into the collar of my jacket. It's still night for sure, and the stars twinkle like fiery globes all above us. And Sirius hangs just above the roof of the barn, sparkling with red and blue and white light as we slip past the barn door, sliding it open just enough so we can squeeze through and then closing it behind us. Lemon comes quietly to my hand and noses into my fingers, but doesn't say anything. Even when I kneel down against him, rubbing his great head against my chest. "Hi, Lemon. Hi, Lemon." And I know his mouth smiles when I rub his ears, but still he doesn't say anything back to me. And I turn the light on in the tack room and leave its door open so that the light spreads out into the barn, and I hear Whitney over by Blue's stall whispering to him while he stands up on a hay bale and watches down past the animal whose head is lifted up in the frail light with his legs folded and tucked under him and his gentle eyes blinking against our intrusion. "Hi, Blue. Hi, Blue." And I stand beside Whitney and watch into the stall at the horse's face as he continues to blink into wakefulness with his lovely pale eyelashes. We can hear animals down the other line of stalls in the L-shaped barn, restive in the darkness and groaning yet with sleep, and one of them drinking and knocking against his stall, and another whinnying softly as if to himself, instantly reminding me, then in memory as well as now, how I've always loved the voice of horses for my entire life. "It's too late," I whisper to Whitney. "We got here too late." And Whitney whispers back to me, "I know, but next year we have to remember." And I whisper back at him, "Yes, we have to remember next year." He always plays Silent Night last, maybe three or four times, all strung together. And everybody knows the words to it, and we all of us sing it with him. And without knowing why, the beauty of the music with all the people huddled together, warm out of the vast cold, under the delicate candlelight, out of the vast dark, makes me feel as if the beauty, which I didn't then know the word for it, was nearly too big to hold all at once, as if it were somehow just too big. So for a moment, I have to stop my singing and swallow two or three times before I can make the sound come back up out of me. I'm leaning against Elizabeth's legs as she sets against Spencer, sitting on a couple of hay bales, with Whitney leaning against his legs and against me, and Lonnie on Spencer's other side with Spencer's arm around him and his other hand resting on Whitney's shoulder, and Elizabeth's arm around Spencer's back, and her other hand resting over my chest. And by the time we come to the sleep in heavenly peace line, her hand lifts off me and rises to her face for a moment, and then rests back over my chest so that I can see her face again in my mind without turning to look up at her, even knowing the water in her eyes and slipping over her cheek like a line of quicksilver in the candlelight. And her hand goes off me again and rises up and then back down, and rests against me again. And I don't have to look at it either, laying warm on me, because I know how it looks in my mind too, just as I know her face. Besides, I can't take my eyes off the candles. How wondrous a vision they are to me for some reason. As we sit there singing, the quivering light all interlaced through the trees, making me think of how aspen leaves quiver when the wind blows into them in the middle of summer, so that if they were to become any kind of light, they would probably be the leaves that the candlelight would turn into, because they seem to quiver in a delicate kind of rustling movement in just exactly the same way. Sleep, I think, for all the massed days and clicking years of my tiny, flickering life. Sleep. I think of Spencer, whose soul parties with the antelope, smelling of sage and horse lather, and covered by the insubstantial globe of a great tumbleweed, whose dry and vein-like branches try to hold the silent wind. Sleep. I think of Elizabeth, who blows, like her long damp hair from under the firm hand of the sea wind, watching forever the endless monument of the fastened waves as she rises and falls on a white gull's wing that are flawed with a single spot of red, singing to Spencer, who circles her tirelessly on the darkened wings of a hawk that are tipped with scarlet. Sleep. I think of Lonnie, who carries his gentleness like a food to be offered to anyone that approaches him, hungry for it or not. His silvery wings but pin feathers and marked as with an obscure necklace of crimson, like something hovering in the air that is still colored by it long after sunset. And sleep, I think to myself, for all of us. For all of us beating fiercely against the wind or lying placidly beneath its cool flow with broken hands and wondrous wings and blinded eyes that see even beyond seeing, the same wordless dream built of the same heart-crushing sorrow and the same unspeakable loveliness all at the same time. How beautiful and sad it is, all at the same time. And sleep, I think, for all of us. Sleep, I think, at last. Oh, sleep in heavenly peace. Sleep.